Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking with Stephen Caliendo, who is the co-author with Charlton McIlwain of the book Race Appeal, How Candidates Evoke Race in U.S. Political Campaigns. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Welcome to New Books in Political Science. Welcome, Stephen Caliendo. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for having me, Heath.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure, and it's a real pleasure to have read your book, Race Appeal, that you've co-authored with Charlton McIlwain. Before we get started talking about this really interesting book, maybe you can talk just a little bit about your own background and also how perhaps you formed this research collaboration with your co-author.
Sure. I'm a broadly trained Americanist in political science. My dissertation was on political socialization and attitudes toward U.S. political institutions. And so I was exploring why the U.S. Supreme Court held the kind of a greater sense of diffuse support in the mass public as it compared to the presidency and the Congress. And I had a theory that it had something to do with the way we learned about the court in our government classes in high school, because that's one of the few times we learn about the court in a systematic way. So I spent a lot of time in high school talking to government teachers and reading government textbooks and interviewing and surveying high school students. And, my real interest, I think, there was one of legitimacy, questions about the court's ability to maintain it, to enforce its decisions or inability to enforce its decisions, but, get folks to comply with decisions. And so I had these bigger questions about representation. But really nothing to do specifically with race, and only tangentially to do with political psychology, and very much detached from political communication. So, as so many of us, what we study in graduate school doesn't necessarily become what we base our careers upon. I met Charlton McIlwain in the summer of 2000 at Princeton University. He and I were both participating in the Junior State of America program, which is a program for high schoolers to sort of learn about democracy, and they run summer schools. At the time, they ran them at Princeton, Georgetown, Stanford, and Yale, and still run them in all those places with the exception of Yale, where high school students will take college-level classes from college professors in communication and political science. Charlton's PhD from the University of Oklahoma is in communication, and he's on the faculty at New York University now. And of course, my background's in political science, and we started to realize that we had some common interests. Charlton, his dissertation was on death rituals and the cultural differences. He spent a lot of time in funeral homes and attending funerals. Yeah, it's really the feel-good research of the summer. But it was culture-based and it was race, and I had some interest in social justice very broadly, and as we started to talk, we realized that he was interested in politics, and there wasn't a lot of systematic studying of race-based communication in the political system, and so we decided to launch a project in 2001 where we would engage in social science research on this question, and It grew fairly quickly after that to have an online presence with raceproject.org, which we still maintain. And then, as is natural, I guess, in the first part of the 21st century, we added social networking. So we have the Twitter feed and the Facebook page, which have become really amazingly popular, not because of what we do. We mostly just share information there. We don't put much of our own work there, with the exception of some announcements when we're giving speeches and so forth. But it's a place where people share and talk about race and politics, the intersection. I know some faculty members have required their students to read it or post on it a certain number of times as part of course assignments. And so we're just really pleased about the community outreach part of what we're doing with the Race Project. But the scholarship is why we started it. And Race Appeal, the book that we're talking about today, is the culmination of the first 8 years of that project. Which is, looks like it's a project that doesn't have an end, doesn't have an end point. Mm-hmm. So this is the first 8 years.
Yeah, that's great. And so, and to be clear, given when we're doing this interview, the book itself doesn't address this most recent election, but we would like to talk about that once we
get through this and see what, you know, how the analysis holds up in 2012 and looking forward. But before we get to that, let's talk about the actual book, which I really enjoyed. And I, it's my own research. I thought it was integrated well. And this background that you talked about of the two of you, I think, comes through in a real varied theoretical approach and a varied literature that you draw on. Yeah, at the start of the book, you write the following. You write, in this book, we proceed from the premise that our current situation 20 years after Willie Horton and approaching a decade since Mendelberg's book was published demands a renewed look at the political landscape of race-based appeals in American electoral discourse. So first, maybe you could remind us about Willie Horton. Some of the details have been lost over that 20 years. So maybe you could just start by sort of establishing why that's the, you know, one of the starting points for your work.
Right, sure. I mean, and it's a starting point primarily because it got so much scholarly attention. It was the one political ad that dealt with race, that got some scholarly attention. And really, I mean, this tacks back, of course, it tacks back the whole way through our history, back to slavery. But, I mean, if we're thinking about these memes of using race as campaign leverage, certainly we could think of Nixon's Southern strategy. And I think we probably need to think about Ronald Reagan's 1980 campaign, where he invokes the welfare queen narrative that racializes the welfare issue, and also serves to galvanize white folks in their common stereotypes about African Americans being lazy, getting things to which they're not entitled, those types of things. And of course, other stereotypes about African Americans that have been pervasive include tendency toward criminality, untrustworthiness, and violence. And that's where Willie Horton comes in. And in 1988, a PAC ran an ad, or produced an ad, a series of ads, about Michael Dukakis' furlough program in the state of Massachusetts, arguing that it was a revolving door, that prisoners that were furloughed committed crimes when they were out on leave. There were a couple of ads, and one was a case study, a featured story of a man named William Horton. And I think it's still unclear whether or not he ever went by Willie. There's some suggestion that maybe he was called that in a way to further racialize him. But in any case, he, while he was on furlough, committed some heinous crimes. And in the ad, in the process of describing these crimes, and attaching them to Michael Dukakis, the Democratic nominee for president, Willie Horton's image was shown, a couple of different images of Willie Horton. One was his mugshot. He has a rather bushy beard. He has an afro hairstyle, which was important in terms of symbolizing the racial aspect of it, and other images as well. But the point is that it wasn't widely shown, but it was discussed tremendously. And it was discussed because the suggestion was that adding Willie Horton's image gave additional persuasive appeal to the message because it triggered our sometimes latent but quite powerful in any event predispositions about black men and violence and sexual violence. In fact, the act he committed was a rape. And so Jesse Jackson and some other leaders cried foul. There was some discussion about whether this was racist or not. Lee Atwater, who was the chair of the Republican National Committee at the time, of course, disavowed any dirty tricks or whether or not there was racist intent. It wasn't his ad anyway, by the way. It was a PAC. But it got some scholarly attention. The reason we argue that it needed to be revisited, is because, not because of this one particular ad, but because we wondered how a message like that, as powerful as it might be between two white candidates and playing on our collective fears and prejudices about race, how it might work if the target was a person of color, in this case an African American, or a person of color where the prejudice would be maybe transferred then from the subject of the message to the actual candidate himself or herself. And so we set out to study race-based messages in campaigns that involved at least one candidate who was not white.
And, you know, you mentioned sort of this is an ad that that ultimately wasn't shown that much. You know, you just wonder what the power of an ad like that would be when it could be reshown as ads now are anywhere immediately via different social media and YouTube. You 20 years later, you sort of think that, well, everyone could have seen the ad, but you realize that it probably was shown in commentaries on the subject, but a lot of people probably never even saw the actual ad itself in 1988. Do you have any sense of during that time period, what the awareness was? Was it primarily on the scholarly side, or was it hotly debated at the time? Were people aware of just the significance?
They were. It wasn't shown as an ad in proper very much, but it was debated on nightly newscasts, et cetera. It was part of the campaign discourse at the time, for sure. And one of the things that Mendelberg so brilliantly is able to demonstrate in her book that we reference in the throughout, of course, we build on her and credit her deeply, but the section that you read suggested that she was able to help us understand that Horton Ad points out that so long as the message stays implicit, that is, there isn't text-based race, right? And one of the things that the folks behind that ad could say was, well, we didn't mention race. You mentioned race. We didn't say it was black. We didn't say African-American. We didn't say the word race. We didn't say white. We didn't say any of these words. We simply told a story, and we put the picture of the guy who did it, and nothing in there was a lie. He did it. And so there's this plausible deniability that's really helpful. And one of the things Mendelberg points out is that once it moves from the implicit to the explicit. That is, once folks recognize that there's race at work, the message doesn't work any longer because we push back on it, because we have this, what she calls the norm of racial equality. This sense, and this is not white folks, this is everybody, that we ought not be prejudiced. We ought not judge people based on the color of their skin. And so as long as I'm making a judgment that might be related to race, but I'm not aware that it's related to race, there's potential for effect. But when I suspect that race is at work, I'm going to push back on it. And that's something that Charlton and I found in the experiments that we ran for race appeal as well.
Yeah, and speaking of that, you raise sort of one of the difficult aspects of dealing with an issue like this outside of simple kind of commentary or sort of theoretical back and forth, which is how do you actually study this? And you guys have a number of different approaches to your method. So what did you do? How did you write this book?
Yeah, this was tricky. You know, we were both committed, I think, in our own ways to multi-methodological approaches to exploring phenomena anyway. But as you suggested a few moments ago, I mean, the fact that Charlton's training in communication, which is especially in a program like Oklahoma's, which is a very good program in communication, that the training is at once humanities-based, that is, that there are constructivist approaches to it. You know, Charlton has a strong background in semiotics, I think, that comes through in a number of these chapters very nicely and adds tremendously. But he's also trained as a social scientist, because that's a very important part about what modern communication scholars do, many modern communication scholars do. And as a political scientist, I'm almost entirely trained as an empiricist, positivist, with lots of statistical training. And so I think that we both had a healthy appreciation for the fact that if we're going to really make an improvement over what we know now, we've got to come at this from a number of angles, not just a number of substantive angles, which we did. We looked at ads. We looked at media coverage of ads. We did some controlled experiments that got to some of the psychological underpinnings and then case studies, but that we were going to use a number of methodological approaches. I think that the first chapter, the chapter that is certainly took us the longest amount of time to write, is a content analysis of over 700 ads throughout history, ads for Congress, that featured at least one non-white candidate. And so what that involved was our identifying the candidates, or the races that we were involved in, that is the election contests that we were interested in, I should say, and finding which of those spots from those contests were available at the archive, at the Julian Cantor Political Communication Archive at the University of Oklahoma. And as you well know, Heath, the very glamorous work of a social scientist takes you to exotic locations like Norman, Oklahoma, where you hole yourself up in the back room of the communication department for days on end watching campaign spots with spreadsheets and coding with handfuls of candy in the middle of the table. So that we spent lots and lots of hours. I'm sorry.
I sure hope it was the summer there because that's the best time of year.
You know what? We always tried to make sure that we didn't have to fly in the wintertime. Yes. So that was that, and you know, we could talk about how we, you know, because the whole goal there was really to get past this sort of false dichotomy of an ad's racist or it's not. And so we construct this index of racist potential that allows a more objective counting with some weights associated to it so that an ad that has some racist potential has greater or lesser degree of it, that it is not just simply it's racist or it's not. I mean, that's what you get on cable news, right? I mean, they run an ad and somebody will say, that's a racist ad. No, it's not a racist ad. And then where do you really go from there? And so we tried to have some more objective measures with theoretical justification and then some sliding in there.
Yeah, and the methods I found both very interesting, very advanced in terms of their approach, but also really did make sense. I think even if someone's background wasn't in social science methods, there was just the way it was presented, I think, was very readable. Now, I have a real personal interest in immigration and immigration policy, and you have a chapter where you come at this directly, Chapter 5. And in that chapter, you write, the real threat here is that these immigration ads produce a particular discourse about immigration and immigration policy. The real danger is that these ads produce a discourse about immigration that irrationally frames how we view the issue and colors the measures we propose to solve the problem. And so on the issue of immigration, what was your approach? And sort of put that, this sort of quote pulled out kind of somewhat randomly, put that into the context of how you approach the issue of immigration and immigration policy.
That chapter is a sort of a drill down case study of a particular year, 2006, which was a hot year for immigration policy discussion, as you know, but also it turns out that it's a congressional election year. So that interaction then provided us with an opportunity to examine the types of race-based messages that were occurring, not just in ads that featured a Latino, although there were those as well, but how candidates were using the issue of immigration to make persuasive appeals. And as will not surprise you or the listeners, there were lots of them that seemed to do so pretty clearly. And I'm using my words carefully here, Ethan, and I hope this comes through in the book. You know, one of the things we avoid doing as social scientists here, we make a conscious decision, we're not labeling people as racist. The person who made the ad is racist, or the candidate is racist. We're labeling the messages as being racist. That is, the message has the potential for greater power as a result of our longstanding history of racism. And so, keeping that in mind, there were lots of racist messages in that 2006 cycle. If Mendelberg is right, and we believe that she is, that the real racial power comes not from the language used, but the images shown, then this chapter is a powerful example of how that works, because it was ad after ad after ad of brown people climbing over fences, of brown people getting put in handcuffs, of constant links between immigration and crime. And again, you know, we're not talking about, you know, immigrants from Germany or immigrants from Canada. We're talking about Mexican immigrants, Central and South American immigrants and more broadly, but mostly Mexican immigrants. And so it's very easy then, especially in an issue that people associate with crime anyway, that is, coming into the country illegally is one crime, that the suggestion is, well, if you're willing to commit one crime, you're willing to commit all sorts of crimes. And so the fear factor is already in place. It just needs to be activated. And we saw it activated over and over again in 2006.
Yeah, and, you know, on that point of the nuance that you get to in the book, this is a nuance that's often difficult when someone doesn't read the book, but hears clips of it or reads an excerpt of it. And I know that you you talk about this book, not just now, but you talk about it in other settings. Has that been difficult to try to get interviewers or people, commentators, to pay attention to those nuances that you've gone out of your way to present?
I haven't been particularly challenging in the interviews or during the public lectures themselves. I mean, you tend to see a lot of head nodding. I mean, I think it makes intuitive sense to people that if you separate structural racism from individual level bigotry, if you separate implicit from explicit racism, if you then follow those guideposts then and do what we did, which is label messages either racist or racial, which is using race but not in a way that leverages longstanding predispositions, people kind of nod their heads slowly like, okay, I see, it makes sense. That is part of in our public discourse, one of the things that's quite troubling is that any discussion of race becomes racist. That if I mention race, or if you mention race, or if someone mentions race, that's racism. You're not supposed to be talking about race, because Martin Luther King said you're not supposed to judge people by the color of their skin. Mm-hmm. And so we've gotten to this place where you can't talk about race without being racist. But what that leaves open then is this horrible Orwellian situation where the only people that are getting called racist are the folks who are trying to have meaningful discussions about race and pointing out when race is being used in a way that's detrimental to our democracy. Mm-hmm. And so that's troublesome. And so I think that people acknowledge that we need to make these distinctions. The challenge, and what I'm not able to answer for you, is whether or not after we leave the lecture hall or leave the interview, that then permeates into other parts of folks' lives, that we're going to start to make those meaningful, both semantic and theoretical shifts to make sense of this. Because if we continue to use this blunt language about racism, that everybody's racist, anybody who talks about race is racist, then that only serves to reinforce the status quo, which should be really troubling to folks who want to see improvement in our systemic racial justice situation in this country.
Yeah, and then towards the end of the book, you sort of make this point in the conclusion. You say, as long as racial discourse in America remains stalled in gotcha mode, no further meaningful progress is likely to be made. Sort of in that context, maybe we could look at this 2012 election, which is not part of the study. And so,
sure.
But what did you make of 2012 in light of what you did? Is this more of the same of the patterns that you saw or you observed? Or did you see change in the positive or the negative direction?
Well, I mean, as you know, we had a case study of the 2008 Obama election in this book as well, in that part two with the case studies. And, you know, it was full of lots of examples of ways that race was being leveraged in campaign discourse. I am not happy to say that we did not see an improvement. I mean, I'm not making a quantitative judgment. We didn't, like, add them up or
mm-hmm.
anything. But in terms of the messages that were coming through, the only reason there was somewhat of a decrease is because the Democrats weren't involved. Right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you read that chat, it's funny because we've been giving lectures in the last couple of weeks, and often the Republicans in the room are upset because they're saying, you're just picking on the Republicans. But anybody who's read the book usually chirps right up and says, well, you ought to read their book because they're not just picking on Republicans. The fact of the matter is, the Democrats didn't have a primary season to go through this time. And so the Democrats were not attacking Barack Obama. In fact, it was mostly the Republicans. But if you look in 2008, a significant, I think more, there were more examples of race-based communication in the primaries. And that is from Barack Obama himself, but then also the racist message from his opponents and their surrogates, than there was during the general election with John McCain. John McCain didn't get involved in very much at all. He did run a couple ads that accused the president of welfare, but for the most part he was. But we got lots of the Geraldine Ferraro and the Hillary Clinton and the Joe Biden and all kinds of examples from the Democrats. This year we saw it only from the Republicans, but we saw a good bit of it, and it was fairly consistent. One thing that I will say that I've noticed that was different is the shift was less about President Obama's trustworthiness. In 2008, there was lots of, do you really know who he is? Just as you suspected, he's hiding something. You've got to know who his friends are. He's not who he says he is. Well, that stuff isn't going to fly very well after we've had 4 years of his administration. We know who he is at this point. That wasn't going to work. The shift was more toward the entitlement, the lazy, not hardworking. And again, not that the president was specifically, but tying him with people, quote unquote, like him. So lots of, you know, there was a sign early on a Romney campaign ad that it says Obama isn't working, and had like an unemployment line. And that works on a couple of levels, right? It means that his administration isn't working for America, but also it has this Obama isn't working, like the black man's not working, sort of double entendre that's happening. You know, Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich with the food stamp president sort of stuff. Sarah Palin, late in the campaign, talked about Obama shuck and jive on the Benghazi situation. So, you know, we have lots and lots of examples. I wish that we didn't have a lecture, right? I wish that the lecture was about the book, and we could say, and we didn't see any of this in 2012. Thank you very much. Any questions? But that's not right. The lecture has been disproportionately focused on 2012, with lots and lots of examples about handouts, food stamps.
Yeah, and moving forward, what's next for you? Are you guys going to continue working on the subject together? Are you working on any new projects that are going to result in a new book in 2013 or 2014?
Nothing that quickly. Nothing that quickly. I have a textbook on inequality in America coming out with Westview next year. It's a design to be companion to American government. That's on my own. Charleston and I have two major. The race project is going to continue in various forms. Two major research elements that are coming out of it. The one is will be fairly soon and a little bit less academic. We're doing an update of Randall Kennedy's book on the N-word. And we're using a couple of interesting angles that, of course, Kennedy wasn't able to use when he wrote the book a decade ago, looking at social networking. We're also going to do some social norm violation experiments where we're going to have folks carry around Randall Kennedy's book, which has the word spelled out across the cover, in public settings, and see what kind of experiences that they have with that word in sort of the Obama era. What does it mean? N-words. So that'll be coming pretty quickly. The longer term, I mean, I don't know why we have to take 8 to 10 years to write everything, but the longer term project that we're working on really stems from the last paragraph in Race Appeal. And at the end of Race Appeal, we say, somewhat presumptuously, in retrospect, I think, that social sciences may have gotten about as far as we can get in terms of understanding, the way race affects people's, evaluation of candidates with these sort of behavioral measures. And so we have turned to psychophysiological models, which don't promise everything, but I think with the way technology has progressed, we can learn a lot. So we partnered with a very accomplished neuroscientist at New York University who has a functioning lab to start to show the same sorts of ads that we showed folks for Race Appeal, and then ask questions of their judgment of candidates afterwards. We want to measure the electronic activity in their brain as they're watching these ads, and we want to measure their heart rate variation, and we want to measure their skin conductance, and we want to watch how often where their eyes move on the screen when different parts of the ad are shown. The theory here is that so much of our norms are move us toward the belief that we treat people equally and that we don't have prejudices, it becomes more and more difficult to try to ask questions to tap into those latent predispositions. And so we're going to try to measure how the body responds in a preconscious format to some of these messages and see where we can go from there, connecting them in some ways to the behavioral measures as well. And those are in the interim. Folks might be familiar with the implicit associations test out of Harvard, for instance. And anyway, trying to see how we can put these things together and make a greater sense out of how candidates might be affected by race-based communication.
Well, it sounds like a really interesting project. For the time being, Race Appeal, How Candidates Invoke Race in U.S. Political Campaigns, which was published last year, 2011, by Temple University Press, which I'm sure is available at their website and on Amazon, was published by Stephen Caliendo and Charlton McElwain. Stephen, thank you so much for your time today.